Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here today. We have one case that's being argued this morning at 10 a.m., and it's my understanding that the attorneys have checked in and they're ready to go. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left is Justice Brian Walker, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we begin the argument, I'll have the clerk please read the case. You may begin.
Good morning. My name is Jim Floyd. I represent the Harriets, which are the appellates in this matter. To best summarize our position in this matter, I believe this is a case of equity. What happened in this matter is that the Harriets, my clients, were purchasing a piece of real property that is their home and some land. They entered into an oral contract with Mr. Banta. Mr. Banta passed on June 18th of 2020. Up until that time, my clients made a down payment of $40,000 on the real estate. In addition to the $40,000 down payment, they made $17,306 of monthly payments regularly during the term from the time that they entered into this agreement until Mr. Banta passed. In addition, they paid ad valorem taxes on the property of $7,174.45, as well as home, and that includes homeowners insurance. So my clients had homeowners insurance that they paid. They paid ad valorem taxes, they made monthly payments, and they had a $40,000 down payment on this piece of real estate.
And what in the records supports this?
Point
me to the evidence of this.
I'm sorry?
Point me to the evidence of this.
Well,
trial.
Okay. So as part of the affidavits that they swear out, my clients swear out, they claim those payments were made. However, the numbers are not in the affidavits. They were argued at court. What happened at the trial court when the trial judge called this matter, first of all, we weren't given proper notice. We've argued that. That notice came in the form of a letter from the temporary administrator telling us that there was going to be a hearing. Throughout their brief, they refer to it as an evidentiary hearing. There is no such reference in the record that it's an evidentiary hearing. When we got to the hearing, the court asked the temporary administrator for his position. His position was that the contract could not be enforced because it violated the statute of frauds. He then asked me for my position. My position was partial performance, in fact, substantial performance, which is what I was just referencing of these payments. Then he asked the temporary administrator for authority for him to rule. The temporary administrator read him a rule out of the state code, and he ruled. There was no opportunity to put on evidence. The only evidence that exists on either side are affidavits. And so it's our position that if the court accepts the affidavits, that is sufficient evidence to at least allow for an evidentiary hearing back at the trial court. Or in the alternative, that if the court says the affidavits are not valid, then neither affidavit is valid. It has to be what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Counselor, did you complain about the lack of notice when you got to the hearing? It appears to me that the first time that it was addressed was on appeal, that you actually complained about it.
That's correct, Your Honor. I did not complain about it at the trial court.
What rule would allow these affidavits to be used as evidence? Because they're normally hearsay.
Correct. And so they are statements by a party opponent and statements by a party itself, and I believe that's an exception to the hearsay rule.
If, in fact, this was an evidentiary hearing, who had the burden? What burdens were available to you? My understanding is it was a motion to sell the property. Whether you were given proper notice or not, you appeared at the hearing, so you had actual notice of a hearing. The state was asked for its position first and put on no evidence. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then you were asked for your position and you put on no evidence.
Other than the affidavits, correct.
But those were affidavits that have been attached to your response, which was a objection to the sale.
Correct.
Okay. So is it your position that the estate had the burden of establishing that in fact it owned the property in order to be able to request the opportunity to sell it?
Yes. And because they did not put on any evidence, arguably, although I would have liked to have put on evidence, and just so the court knows, this was done via Zoom. I had both my clients present, ready to put on evidence. But the judge ruled and said, in fact, the judge said as soon as he ruled, if Mr. Floyd wants to take me up on appeal, he can. And the hearing was over.
You didn't try to make some kind of offer of proof? You didn't try to...
I did not. I wanted to, but I did not.
Was it because of the nature of the technology? Was it because he just ended it?
He ended it.
End?
Well, he ended it, and that was it. And his comment was, if Mr. Floyd wants to take me up on appeal, he can, and the hearing was over.
Okay.
In Zoom, and you can't really control whether you stay in the courtroom or not, because once you're cut off, you're cut off.
Correct. And as I said, I had both Mr. and Mrs. Harriet sitting with me in my office ready to testify, but I never had the opportunity to put on that evidence.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, I mean, where I think probably all three of us, our minds are kind of going is, you know, oftentimes when you don't complain about something, you waive it. And, you know, but the nature of not actually being given an opportunity to be heard because of the technology is something. Give me something a little bit more if you can.
Sure. So in addition to that, I argued at the hearing that there was substantial performance, I believe is the term I used, but it's partial performance is what it says in the case law, Justice Walker. And so when we did that and we put on that, we made that argument. That was the only opportunity we had. We listed the amounts of money, over $70,000, that had been paid towards this $200,000 piece of property. And the judge surreptitiously ruled against us. That's what happened. And so there wasn't an opportunity to put on the evidence. And I will tell you, in as complete candor, as honest as I can be, I had deer in the headlights. I was shocked. I was completely floored and did not have that opportunity.
Let me get you to set this table. So it is a motion to administer an asset, what is being represented to the court, an asset of the estate, correct?
The motion at the trial court?
In other words, the motion for the sale is to sell what is purported to be an asset of the estate.
What it's purported to be, correct.
You know whether or not there was any evidence in the record that would indicate that, in fact, it was an asset of the estate. Was there any evidence attached to the motion for sale that indicated it was an asset of the estate?
No.
Okay. And your objection made it clear that you were objecting to it's being considered to be an asset of the estate, because you were saying, look, this is property that we purchased and we are in the process of purchasing
correct.
It.
Correct.
So we're not in a position to actually say that your objection conceded the fact that the property was an asset of the estate at that point in time. Is that correct?
I'm not sure I understand.
In other words, if you had just said, yes, it's an asset of the state, but we think we've got an interest in it, or we're entitled to reimbursement on something, or something of that nature,
right,
that would have conceded that it was, in fact, an asset of the estate.
Right. We never conceded that.
But your objection contested that it was an asset of the estate because you were effectively arguing that it had been transferred to your clients at that point in time.
Correct.
Okay. So at the close of the hearing, the court had heard nothing with regard to whether or not the asset was actually an asset of the state. No deed had been introduced into evidence, nothing of that nature. Is that correct?
That's correct. The temporary administrator did put on no evidence of it being a part of the estate.
Okay. So you didn't have time to make an offer of proof, according to you, but why didn't you pursue a formal bill of review? Or did you try?
No, I did not try to do a bill of review. The reason was that I felt like that the best course at that point in time was to get this court to hear the argument so that I could hopefully, on behalf of my clients, have an equitable relief under the partial performance rule exception to the statute of frauds. And that was the only way I thought we could do it, because I had already argued it to Judge Wren, and he had surreptitiously said no. And when I wasn't allowed to put on evidence, I felt like this was the best avenue for my client to be able to have a new set of ears.
Okay, counsel, you're saying he surreptitiously did something that would suggest he's doing something that he's not supposed to be doing. Are you suggesting, what evidence do you have that that's the case, or are you just simply characterizing it because you were upset that he ruled in the manner that he did?
In the latter, Justice Birdwell, I apologize. I'm not suggesting the judge did something intentionally wrong. He made a ruling. I was not allowed to put on evidence on behalf of my clients, and I was upset.
And he overtly did it. I mean, he clearly ruled and then told you if you want to appeal it, you'll...
Absolutely.
Would you not agree that you have a difficulty, even if we accept all the evidence that you've identified in terms of your affidavit attached to the First Amended, you have a difficulty in demonstrating formation of contract because, first, you've got a written contract that your clients have presented through you, but it has different terms. I don't even think it has the total amount of $200,000 on it, but it's got a $900 and change monthly term. Your clients ended up paying $500 and change as a monthly term. The $500 change, would you not agree, is consistent with a lease? And so where can we find there's actual formation of the contract here, even under your equitable principles?
Sure. So I would say two things, Justice Birdwell. Number one, there clearly was a meeting of the minds. And we can tell that because monthly payments were made and they were accepted. My clients occupied the property the entire time uninterrupted. There was never an intent to get them out.
But possession and monthly payments are also consistent with a lease.
But what is not consistent with the lease is a $40,000 down payment, homeowner's insurance paid by my clients, ad valorem taxes paid by my clients, and over $7,000 of home improvements. That is totally inconsistent with the lease. That is someone who is purchasing a home. There is not a lease. I do TAA work across the state. The TAA lease and any other lease, including the Texas Realtors lease, none of those suggest that there would ever be a down payment, that there would ever be ad valorem taxes paid, that there would ever be homeowner's insurance. It's called renter's insurance. Those things are wholly inconsistent with the lease. And so when you look at that in the totality of the facts...
Well, and the renter's insurance only covers the personality of
people
renting, and this was homeowners, which covered...
The dwelling.
The dwelling itself.
But we only know that from the affidavits.
Correct. Which were not objected to. They were accepted, and in fact, in the appellee's brief, they acknowledged the receipt of those affidavits, which were filed the day after the objection was made. And so they didn't object to them. They didn't raise any issue as to it. And I would say that if nothing else, at the trial level,
But they weren't offered and admitted.
They were offered to the court. They were not offered into evidence at a hearing because I was never given that opportunity. But they... What I would argue is that if nothing else, they allowed it to be tried by consent. There was no objection to those affidavits.
And it's some evidence is what you're saying.
Correct.
Some evidence.
Correct.
If this may be hasty, if we remanded this, I hear your theories, but how are you going to prove it? Other than some self-serving statements. I mean, you see the problem that... You know, I could say that I spent $400,000 on a down payment, but if I don't necessarily have proof of it, then
we do
problematic.
I'm sorry, Justice Walker, I didn't mean to interrupt you. We do have proof of it, and that's what we will put on. In addition, Mr. Banna had a common law wife, and her deposition was taken after we entered this case, and we weren't even given notice of it. Now, I know that's ancillary, but it goes to your evidence question, because I would either depose or call the common law wife, who also accepted those payments and has had numerous conversations with my clients about those issues.
In other words, you have a plan.
Yes, very much so.
But you know that law generally does not give you a second bite at the apple if you fail to bring your proof at the first trial.
I understand, but I still contend that I wasn't given that opportunity.
Now, the question was asked about a bill of review, obviously asked about the offer of proof. If I recollect right, there was no motion for new trial that was filed in this case.
That's correct.
Same reasoning, same rationale for not doing so?
Yes, Justice Walker.
I know the record doesn't show this, but how old was Banta when he died?
My recollection, he was in his 50s, but Justice Birdwell, I can't tell you that for sure.
I was just wondering because, and nobody's argued this, but it was just a question I had, is how many almost $600 payments would it take to get to $200,000? And if he was like 70 or 80, that somehow he would not be expecting to get most of those payments. If he was in his 50s, then he might be expecting to get most of those payments. I'm just looking for...
And they were close family friends. And so, I mean, the record eventually will show that there was additional offers that were made on the property for more money, and he turned them down because of the friendship that he had with the Harriets.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Patrick Krim, and today I'm going to be arguing on behalf of Brian Hill as now independent administrator for the estate of Terry Banta. I wasn't planning on doing this, but because of some of the things that Mr. Floyd stated, I think it's important to walk the court through procedurally actually what happened here. A lot was mentioned about the application for sale of this real property, and the Texas Estates Code is clear about what an administrator has to include in order for that application to go forward. And that is a motion with an affidavit attached to it that lists the property to be sold, which the temporary administrator did in this case. He listed the property by deed and description, and then attached an affidavit in compliance with the statute to present the court with the reasons why it should be sold, why it would benefit the court, and why, obviously, the estate had authority because it was owned by the estate, or at least...
What's the case law when there's an objection in terms of do you not still bear the burden of proof with regard to establishing that property is a part of the estate?
I think if the question had actually been raised as to whether this was estate property or not in terms of the title itself.
Oh, okay. So the title hadn't transferred.
No, Your Honor. There was never a deed filed.
Under their argument, it's an anticipated transfer of title later.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I believe that the objection that Your Honor would be contemplating would be that the estate, this isn't even titled in their name. On its face, there's no presumption that it's their property. And in this case, this wasn't a situation where it was already in the Harriet's name or anyone else's name. And so the application in compliance with the Texas Estates Code, combined with the affidavit, correctly laid out the estate's ownership and got the door open and this moving, Your Honor.
What reference to the deed and to the actual ownership was in the affidavit?
I believe it was by description of the deed of the property, and I believe it might have listed the transaction that got it into Mr. Banta's name. I could be wrong. I don't have the application in front of me, Your Honor, but I believe that's the case. And at no point at the hearing did the appellants actually challenge that the property was not at least currently deeded in the estate's name. Once the application for sale was filed, the Harriets filed not one but two responses in which they alleged that no, there was a contract for a purported sale of the property, a lease to own, I believe they said, in which Mr. Banta agreed to sell it to them. And at the hearing, they were given notice of it. They did not file, other than the responses, they didn't file a motion for continuance, they didn't file a jury demand, they didn't file anything other than these two responses. And so Mr. Floyd showed up to the hearing in which the administrator is attempting to sell property that the Harriets claimed they owned, and the Harriets did not introduce a single shred of evidence. They did not call a single witness. Mr. Floyd talked about wanting to depose Mrs. Memel. He could have done a trial subpoena to have her appeal. He could have had his clients testify. And contrary to what Mr. Floyd stated, the trial court gave everybody an opportunity to argue and present whatever they wanted in this case, Your Honors. This was not a Sopranos end of the series moment where the curtain dropped and it went black and that was it. He went back and forth, and allowed everybody to have their moment. And so for the Harriet Sinnell claim that they weren't given the opportunity defies the record. It defies everything that happened at that hearing. And I believe it also just shows that they were not prepared, Your Honors, or they did not want to proceed.
When did the actual hearing occur? What was the date of the hearing?
Your Honor, I unfortunately don't have it in front of me. I know the order was October 4th, 2021, which I believe was 10 days afterwards because the court ordered a 10-day, pause on it.
Let me ask you this, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
They provide, at least before the hearing, you've got their position with regard to these matters, that $40,000 been paid in down payment. You would agree that that is not something that would indicate they were simply leasing the property, if in fact that was true, correct?
I think it depends, Your Honor. It's important to remember of what specific contract we're looking at. If it's just a standard lease contract, I would
have good counsel, but the estate knows exactly what his accounts looked like, and it would have been easy for you to go back and find 8 payments of $5,000 apiece. Even the IRS would have figured that out.
Well, and that's assuming that the cash was deposited, Your Honor.
Of course, but maybe he just carried around 8 checks with him. I don't know. Or maybe I don't know whether there was cash paid. The point is the estate was the alleged beneficiary of $40,000 worth of down payment, which you would agree is inconsistent with the lease, would you not?
A standard lease, I agree, Your Honor.
And carrying homeowner's insurance would be inconsistent with the lease. You agree with that, too?
In most residential circumstances, I'd agree.
And, of course, paying ad valorem taxes would be inconsistent with leasing it as well.
If the ad valorem taxes were paid, I agree, Your Honor.
And theoretically,
one would think that you would have notice of that with regard to the estate, because if they weren't paid, y'all would be subject to some serious action from the county, would you not?
Well, it's not in the record, Your Honor, but I can represent that the estate has paid past ad valorem taxes.
Take judicial notice that generally the county likes to get their taxes paid. So anyway,
but you would not necessarily know whether they had paid it or you had paid it. You just
exactly.
Know
they
didn't
I'm pay. Not. I'm not saying it was paid by them. I'm just saying that is something that would have occurred under normal circumstances.
I totally agree, Justice Birdwell. And just briefly, I wanted to address your point about the decedent potentially having these 8 checks around. Assuming, for the sake of argument, that the court can look at the payment log that was provided by the Harriets, the court will note that for every $5,000 purported payment towards the $40,000 down payment, they were all cash, in which the Harriets, in their initial letter to the administrator, admitted that there would be no proof of their ability to do so. But I agree with you that just for a standard lease, a $40,000 down payment for a standard lease would not indicate that it's for anything other than some sort of purchase or sale. But again, that we believe that requires an assumption and something that's not necessarily supported by actual proof in this case. But Mr. Floyd began his argument before the court talking about how this case is about equity. And
counsel, before you move on to that, Justice Birdwell asked you a question, and that really was, couldn't the estate at least attempt to verify if payments were made? And then your answer basically was that the estate might find that payments were not made. But the question really went to, that's something that they could look into, correct? That was basically, I think, the thinking and the verbiage that Judge Bird will use.
Absolutely, Justice Walker. And I want to be very clear that the estate has no plans to hold on to any down payment or improvements that can be proven by the Harriets that were actually paid, even though that the state contends that a contract wasn't formed. I think there's a large difference between accepting that some payments were made and admitting or recognizing that a contract was entered into. People can make
that brings me to my next question, which is it your position that if we affirm the decision made by the trial court, that that forecloses any claim the Harriets might have in equity with regard to improvements to the land, with regard to anything that they could demonstrate they had actually done to improve the land for purposes of the sale of that land?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And we have made that representation to the Harriets that in the case that this does go forward and get sold, that for any payments they can prove on the down payment side, that we'd be happy to reimburse it, assuming that there is actually proof presented, which has been the issue with the Harriets throughout this entire case, Your Honor. They appeared at an evidentiary hearing and went forward with a list of purported payments, hoping that the court would accept them as fact. But 150 years of contract law in the state of Texas has narrowed and defined what contract law is. And rarely is a court going to be confronted with a case where it has to do anything else other than apply the law to the facts. And the reality of this case, Your Honors, is that as appellants admit, they've admitted it several times, they intended to enter into a written contract with the decedent, but unfortunately the decedent passed away before it could be consummated. But nonetheless, they're here today asking the court to instead recognize an oral contract that was never yes, Your Honor.
Right, and that would be a real bad statute of frauds problem if there wasn't exceptions to the statute of frauds rule. And that's their whole position, right? I mean, that there was some kind of performance, and ultimately, that's their beef. I mean, that's still a part of contract law, is it not?
I 100% agree, Justice Walker, but we contend that the estate contends that before you even get to the statute of frauds issue and the partial performance issue, the fundamental thing that needs to be first determined is what contract are we talking about here? And they have admitted that their intent was to enter into a written contract. They're not here today seeking to enforce a written contract because there isn't one.
Isn't partial performance something that the law entertains in the area of an oral contract, in a non-written contract? I mean, statute of frauds requires writing. If there's exceptions to the statute of frauds, that entertains the idea that there's an oral contract. And that's their position, that they had an oral contract. And this evidence that they'd like to get into, you know, purports to reinforce that there was some kind of oral contract.
We would disagree, Your Honor. And I understand what Your Honor's saying. But I think there's still a large difference between there being a valid oral contract that is on its face unenforceable under the statute of frauds, unless there's an exception, and there being an intended written contract, which was never consummated, and one of the parties coming forward and trying to enforce it as an oral contract. And that goes back to fundamental contract basics, Your Honor. And there has to be a meeting of the minds, which was contested by the administrator below, that if one of the parties or either of the parties intend that the contract isn't final until a written contract is formed, then there's no meeting of the minds. And the case law says that if a written draft is proposed or provided, it's evidence that a written signed contract was intended and wouldn't be final until closing. The Beaumont Court of Appeals has held that in Gilbert v. Texas. Dallas Court of Appeals has held that in Principal Life Insurance v. Revlin. And in this case, the appellants themselves have introduced some draft of a financing agreement that purports to list some of the claims. And so we would argue that the meeting of the minds here, if any, was that there was going to be a written contract before any of the terms were finalized.
Well, if that's the case, don't you concede that you can have a contract to contract? You can have an agreement to agree. I mean, it happens all the time in business, does it not?
I do agree with that, Your Honor, but again, there's no evidence of that. And that also leads to the point of we have never been informed, the appellants have never informed the trial court or this court what the actual terms of the purported contract are. All they've introduced is a copy of a financing agreement. And if you actually look at the financing agreement, it says that it's not the actual contract for sale. It says on the very first paragraph that a separate sale contract for the property must be entered into and executed according to the laws of the state in which the property is located. So to this day, we don't actually know what the purported terms of the alleged contract are that the appellants are here seeking to enforce. And that is very important in the context of the statute of frauds exception that they're arguing today.
So what you're saying is this isn't a contract action. This is some other kind of action that wasn't tried. But it's not a contract action because their position is that there was going to be a written contract, and their position is not that there was an oral contract. So whatever payments were made or something, it could be money he hadn't received. I'm just thinking out loud here. It could be some other cause of action, but it's not a contract action.
I think they've firmly stuck their drawn a line in the sand, Your Honor, and said that no. They said that there was a contract for the sale of real property. They attempted to stop the sale by the estate because they said that they are the owners pursuant to an oral lease-to-own contract. They firmly planted their flag there, Your Honor. But the problem is they've also alleged that they have partially performed. And so the only way a court can find partial performance is to actually compare the partial performance to the alleged terms of the contract. And so it creates a position where the court is somewhat handicapped to actually determine what the partial performance is. Now, Mr. Floyd and the appellants have alleged that the documents they've submitted have demonstrate substantial performance.
Let me stop you there. So what we're hearing today from appellant, and we see it in his brief, is that there was an oral contract, that there's an exception in the statute of frauds, and their hope was to try to prove that up. Are you basically saying that even if that was true, once they actually testify or put in their affidavit that we're not could or couldn't look at, depending on your position, that they've said that there was an agreement that they were going to agree later, they were going to have a written contract later, and because they've actually alluded to that, that negates the ability for them to have had an oral contract as to whether or not they should purchase the property? Is that what you're basically
saying? It's our position, yes, Your Honor. And I think the cases say that there can be situations where a written contract was contemplated but never completed, where there still can be an oral contract. But there's got to be some evidence of that. And here, the only evidence is that it was intended to be a written contract and it was never completed. But they... Yes, Your Honor.
Here's my concern, counsel, okay? If we find that there's no formation of a contract here, all right, and we affirm based upon the evidence is insufficient, because if in fact the burden is on the Harriets, it's a sterner burden. It's they've got to prove there's no evidence to support what the court did, and then on top of that, there's conclusive evidence that what they were taking the position isn't, okay? And even on the term of how much is to be paid per month, you've got the written contract says 900 and change. Their affidavit says 500 and change. Conclusive, that burden of proof is difficult, to say the least. If we ever get to that, okay, my concern is we're in equity. We've been asked to be in equity, and equity was invoked in the trial court. And if, in fact, there is evidence that they did make $40,000 of payments with regard to this property, if there is evidence that, in fact, they paid the property taxes, et cetera, equity, it would be a windfall to the estate if we affirmed, but then they could not establish the bona fides of those things.
And the estate is not taking the position. I want to be very clear, Your Honor. The estate is not taking the position today that if the court affirms that the Harriets can't come back and ask for those funds, assuming they can prove it. And the estate is not in the business of taking money from folks that they paid believing, perhaps incorrectly, that there was a contract.
Let me ask you this. What if we affirm that portion of it, remanded back with their rights to seek reimbursement for improvements, et cetera, and then you conduct a little bit of discovery, and sure enough, they've got the accounts that show the $5,000 when they say they paid it, and then you also have some deposits that match up with that. And there's some indication that Mr. Hill knew about those deposits, nevertheless went forward with the sale, and have come to this court and said, well, there's just no evidence of it because it wasn't in the record. You can see why we might be just a little bit upset if that happened, correct?
Certainly, and I understand that, Your Honor. But I think what needs to be noted is that the court can affirm and without any form of remand, and the Harriets can do everything that Your Honor would like to do.
Do you know where in the estate's code that says we can do that?
In terms of just affirm?
we're up here from a jurisdictional standpoint based upon an order of sale, okay? Ordinarily, we don't get jurisdiction unless there's a report on the sale itself, okay?
I agree with that.
We also have this order denying their quote-unquote claim. As far as I understand, their claim is solely that they own the property, but their claim, I don't believe, has said anything about any type of reimbursements. And so the question becomes, because all they've done is made an objection to your request for a sale, they don't appear to have made a formal entrance into this, into the lawsuit with regard to any other claims they might have with regard to reimbursement. Are we going to create a res judicata issue or collateral estoppel issue by affirming under the estates code?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason is that, as Your Honor correctly pointed out, this technically is only in the second phase, or it was only in the second phase of the sales process. But now it's an independent administration. I believe that they can come in and apply for reimbursement, file a claim, because the property hasn't been sold yet, Your Honor. And so that is still open. But the ultimate thing in this case, Your Honor, is that the Harriets have had an opportunity at every moment to stop this, to get the discovery they wanted. They could have filed a motion for continuance. They could have filed a bill of review. They could have filed a motion for new trial. And my guess is the judge would have granted them the opportunity based on the opportunity he gave everyone at the hearing. The fact of the matter is that no evidence was presented, and even if the court considered the evidence, it was the sole judge of credibility and the fact finder, and it found that the statute of frauds applied, and that and because of that, Your Honors, we believe that the court should affirm.
I've got one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think we cut you off. One of us did. I think you, and maybe I'm wrong, I think you were about to address equity in general in response to the appellant's a claim that we should consider the equities here, and I think you got cut off on that thought. And were you about to say that equities are actually on your side?
No, Your Honor. Okay. Well, I'm not saying that we have the right. Let me be very clear.
You got to watch out for her. Yeah.
What I was going to say, Your Honor, is that I understand that equity is a part of contract law. But based on the facts of this case, we believe that all the court has to do is apply well-founded, well-grounded contract law to the facts and find that either no contract was formed, or if it was, that there is no evidence meeting the partial performance exception to the statute of frauds.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And wait a minute, did you have a question?
I have a quick question.
Okay.
Technically, your time's out, but I think you said at the beginning of your argument that you believe that notice was adequate as far as this hearing goes. If that is right, if I heard that right, then how was it adequate in your mind? What is your position?
And I want to very briefly address, and I understand I'm out of time.
Sure, go ahead.
The notice point was raised in a reply brief, which we objected to in a cert reply. We don't think that that was ever raised below, but we did address it, and we addressed it by actually supplementing the clerk's record to provide the notice that was provided. Your Honors, it was notice of the hearing. It said exactly what the hearing was for. The appellants had already filed two replies in which they had listed purported evidence of their claim to the estate. They showed up at the hearing after having already filed that evidence. And so to claim that they didn't know it was going to be a hearing in which this crucial fact was decided, it just defies the record, Your Honor. And so we believe if you look at the actual notice combined with the pleadings, it's clear that they had a reasonable notice of the hearing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Would you add two extra minutes then to the rebuttal time since we went into appellee's?
May it please the court. I'll try to hit a few quick points. First of all, with regard to notice, the statute is very clear. The estate statute is very clear in section 356.252, as we argue, the requirements of an application include that the district clerk must issue the actual notice to the parties involved, and we believe that that notice was inaccurate. However, we showed up in good faith to try to address the court with regard to this matter. And because we were not given the opportunity to put on the evidence and we were cut off, we weren't allowed to do that. There were other ways that, granted, we could have approached this, but seeing what happened that day in court, we felt this was the best avenue, and that was a decision that we made. With regard to the payments, the court, I'm sure, has seen pages 54 and 55 of the court's record, which is a list of all the payments that have been made in this matter. There's no controverting evidence whatsoever that says that they weren't made. Nobody said, because they were made in cash between friends, that it wasn't valid. That's what the evidence show. And I would ask the court to look carefully. We've cited several cases in our brief, but when involving a purchase of land, and I know the court knows this, but just for emphasis, an oral contract within the rule can be enforced by showing one payment of consideration, which is the payment we've talked about and is in the record. Two, possession of the property. It's uncontroverted that the Harriets have lived there since 2018 and has been uninterrupted. There was no attempt to get rid of them or anything else. They were making their house payments, along with ad valorem taxes, along with homeowners insurance, along with home improvements.
Since they first moved in 2018.
Yes. And three, valuable improvements. And that's what I just talked about. That includes new carpet, painting the outside of the house. Those kinds of significant improvements that are in the record, that the receipts are in the record, and that is not what a tenant does. That is what a homeowner does. Improvements, repairing the sprinkler system, those kinds of things, all those receipts are there. Obviously, the purpose, as Justice Walker pointed out, behind having an exception to the statute of frauds is so that a fraud is not perpetuated. And that is that there would be unjust enrichment. When there is a meeting of the minds and there is performance and there are improvements and there is uninterrupted possession, that is when you have a situation where partial performance, in this case, I would argue significant performance, has occurred. There would be unjust enrichment and it perpetuate a fraud because of the statute of frauds if you just enforced the statute of frauds and did not allow for the exception being partial performance. In this matter, not only have the Harriets paid over $70,000, which is an extreme amount and it clearly is not a rental situation, but they have also paid an additional $11,000 into the registry of the court for $1,000 monthly payments. That money is in the registry of the court. They have continued to perform. And as a result, that is not because they're renting or they're holding over of the terms we would use in a landlord-tenant situation. They are making their house payment, and that's what they're doing. They have maintained homeowners insurance. And so the situation is a little foggy because it's hard to know exactly what the Harriets are supposed to continue to do, but they've done everything they can do by continuing to make those payments.
I didn't dig enough in the record to look at this, but do you have any idea, just a guesstimate, what this house is worth?
Well, it's interesting because the temporary administrator says we could buy it from them for $370,000. The argument has been made to me that the house is appreciated and is worth a lot more than $200,000. I think we all know that the property value in Tarrant County has gone sky high. And so that's not unusual. I would consider that a benefit of the bargain from the time that they actually entered into the oral agreement to purchase.
Okay. Real quick question.
Sure.
We've heard of the common law wife. Again, with regard to proof that this is an asset of the estate, is there anything in the record indicating whether this is his separate property, whether any of the payments that were made would be considered to be his separate property, or are we dealing with any type of community property? Does she have any type of remainder interest? Has she agreed to the sale? Anything of that nature? Is there anything in the record with regard to that?
I don't believe it's in the record, Your Honor. I think it's agreed upon by the parties that she was a common law wife. Her deposition was taken, and we were not invited, so I don't know.
But we don't know when the property came into the estate whether it came in while they were in the course of a common law situation, which would arguably make it community property, which would give her interests in the property before they could sell. And the court asked no questions during the hearing with regard to any of those matters. And there's nothing in the affidavit with regard to the sale that indicates her status or the property status vis-a-vis that.
That's correct.
We're not even sure if the court's aware that there is a purported common law wife.
Correct. That's correct. It's not been argued. Essentially, what we're seeking is specific performance under the theory, the exception of partial performance under the statute of frauds. And to not enforce that, or at least allow a proper evidentiary hearing to occur, so that evidence can be put on and a proper ruling can be made, as opposed to a snap ruling, a quick ruling, without that being allowed, is a miscarriage of justice. It would allow the estate to be unjustly enriched. And as much as counsel can say, well, sure, they can come back, and if they can prove these things up, that's the way that they can get their remedy. That's not the proper remedy, because this is not just a piece of real estate. It's their home. And that's not just an asset. That, as we all know, is very important.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments here today. It's been very helpful to us. Your case has been submitted, and we now stand in recess.
Thank you.
Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.